Tonight on The Good Atheist, we talk about rituals and Ryan jumps out of an airplane. Welcome to the show. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Today on the show, we have, I almost feel like this is an interview with you today, because you did something that's pretty crazy, and a huge section of the show is devoted to that crazy thing that you did, which we'll mention in 5 seconds or so. And the second point is I'm going to be explaining some of the things that I, like, some of the crazy things that I'm going to be doing, but that's not kind of crazy in the same way. So let's start about that thing that you did first. Do you want to tell us what happened?
Went on vacation this week, of a sorts. I went back to Ottawa, which is my old stomping grounds, my hometown, and spent a week with friends. And then on the Sunday, the day that I left, I went out to an airport, and I went up in a plane, and then I fell out of that plane to the earth with a parachute.
How long was the fall?
The fall was about 8 minutes or so. It's about a minute of free fall, and then about 7 minutes of parachute falling.
How does the minute of free fall feel?
It's really windy, because as soon as you fall out, you're falling really fast. I don't think people realize how quickly
you gain momentum
and you're falling down, because all it is it's just the wind whipping at you in your face, and you don't even compute the fact that the earth is coming up to meet you. It's so high up, and all you're feeling is the wind blowing in your face as you rapidly descend in the sky. It's pretty crazy.
Well, think about it this way, all right? When you're out in space and you jump out of an airplane, here's what's happening. The Earth is tugging on you, and you're tugging on the Earth, okay? So it's proportional. So that Earth, you've tugged the Earth a tiny little bit. I can't stress how tiny your tug is. You practically can't measure it. But in reaction, you get kind of like, you know, it's force directed at you, so it's dragging you, and the only thing that's preventing you from going faster is, well, essentially the friction from the kind of semi environment that, like, semi atmosphere that you're in. You know, like, it's almost like there is still stuff there. You know, air is stuff. That's why it was really windy. You were going through a lot of it really fast.
Yep.
And so. Let's go back. You were saying before that you wanted to make the jump for a symbolic reason. Is that right?
Yeah. Basically, I was going to turn it into a ritual, because as the listeners of the show might know, we have a couple of different websites. Jake's is The Good Atheist, and mine is Fightlinker. We exchange services on the podcast, and that's how this entire business model developed. I just sold Fightlinker to a large media company in Toronto, and things just weren't feeling real. So I decided I needed to do something severe and crazy and different in order to put it through my mind. And one thing I'd been reading a couple of interesting things about how the brain works and how we operate on things. And one thing is that even though a lot of ritual, you know, like religious ritual or shamanistic ritual or rituals of that manner, they might not work in the way that they're advertised, but there is scientific evidence that backs up the idea that a ritual can have a positive effect on a person's mind. And that kind of leads me over to another thing that I was reading from Sam Harris, who wrote The End of Faith and The Moral Landscape. And one of the things he was talking about in The Moral Landscape is he poo-poos free will. And not in the sense that we're all on a track and everything is known. Although, I don't know, isn't there a mathematical thing that says that everything is and was and always will be as well? Isn't that...
I don't even know where you're going. Anyways,
the whole idea that Sam Harris has about free will isn't so much that everything is locked in and you know, you can't escape whatever you're going to do. He's saying it more in a general sense of you are the result of all of your neurons firing in such a way that you don't even understand what's going on. It's like your surface free will, your understanding of that is very limited indeed, and for the most part you're just being fed shit from your spinal cord and shit from your neurons and in your brain that you can't even begin to comprehend. That's why your friends will often know you better than you know yourself. They'll often be able to tell what's going on better than even you can with yourself half the time, because we're just not as aware of what we are. So my whole point and idea in jumping out of the plane was, number one, to ritualize it, to make it a bigger deal, and to tie it into all of these changes that I wanted to make in this moving forward in my life that I felt that the sale had. And number two was to get, you know, my spinal cord and my brain really behind all of this, to have a traumatic effect, a traumatic event tied into it all that would kind of allow my body and my brain and everything on all levels of consciousness to kind of get with the program and realize shit's different now. You just had a near-death experience, so there, you can now institute change, or your brain might be more susceptible to change. That was my kind of pseudo-scientific attempt when I was jumping out of that plane.
The result?
Well, truth be told, it's hard to focus on all of that stuff when you are falling out of the plane. Your brain almost locks up when you fall out. It's like... does not compute is the best way that I can summarize the experience itself. As soon as you're up against the ledge, you don't have this feeling like, you know, when you're getting into a pool and you don't want to jump in and you're kind of hesitating to jump in, or you're slowly kind of dipping in. There's none of that when you're jumping out of an airplane, at least when you're tandem hooked up to somebody, because the instructor guy is behind you, locked in. You're going out that plane regardless, so as soon as you get up to the edge, everything just kind of gets a little bit surreal, and next thing you know, you're ass over tea kettle out the door. You see the plane, you see the ground, you see the plane, you see the ground, and then you see the ground rushing up, and all the wind is blowing in your face so much that it's like an MTV commercial on steroids. So it was hard to actually push all of those thoughts through during the actual jump, but I definitely felt the chemicals pumping.
I suppose you're still in that phase where you're trying to think about the experience and what it means, or is there just still all a blank?
Well, the jump was the jump, and I wasn't able to assign as much crazy everything to it as I kind of wanted to. I was trying to ritualize on the way up, and I tried to ritualize after I hit the ground, but the jump itself was just, you know, you say you're going to do these things when you're going to try something out, but then when it's actually happening, all that shit just goes out the door. Because even the instructors, they tell you, during the free fall, a lot of people just kind of blank out. Like, the brain just kind of puts that experience in its back pocket, and you don't really remember all that much about it.
Trauma zone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you paid for a trauma zone experience. I hope it was worth the money.
It definitely was worth the money. I'd definitely even do it again. And yeah, it was. I think it was a great experience. And regardless of if it tricks my spine or not, I was able to use it as a really good launching point to kind of move forward. And I definitely feel different. The fact that I was able to just go make the plan, go out and jump out of a plane, definitely signals the fact that life is very different now than it was just a month ago.
Well, I have, you know, I think the problem that you have in terms of maybe the experience not being what you had hoped for is similar to the problem that people have when they try to do New Year's resolutions. I'm not trying to underplay what you're trying to do here.
Yeah, no, go for it.
What I'm trying to say here is New Year's resolution is a good example of a half attempt at a ritual, right? Because yeah. As far as it's concerned, we all obey the same rules. We know what they are. You're just like, okay, well, in this ritual, you take all the things that you want to change, you make a resolution, and you go ahead and you try to make those changes. But the problem with this whole process is, okay, well, what else is there? Nothing. There's no support structure. The one thing that you'll notice about rituals throughout history, whether or not they're religious or they're something else, because, you know, that's something we'll talk about a little bit later, but regardless of all these things, they require a kind of pattern to them, right? It's a system. It makes everything else sort of like just flow because there's an expectation, there's a structure there, you know what to expect, you know when you're doing well, and you have a reward after. I mean, think about how many rituals at the end of it a person gets, a surge of something, right? Like a surge of approval from a community, or now the ability to call yourself an adult, or all kinds of different rites of passages that people sort of had gone through. So I think the problem in this case may have been just the lack of structure. There was none. And plus, you mentioned yourself that before you went on, you were kind of just in your, you know, with your friends, and it was just, all right, everybody in the plane, and you didn't really kind of get to sit down and figure out how the ritual was going to take form. How you could say, I jump from this plane with the understanding that everything else that happened before is just what happened before, and that the thing that I want with my life is to move forward, and I risk my life for this experience. But you didn't get to have that ability just because the structure wasn't really available.
Yeah, the structure of the actual jump, you know, you're jumping with friends, and you've got the instructor there trying to keep everything light and fluffy, because he's probably afraid that if you flip out, you'll, you know, drag him down to his death. So
they have a process. They have their process. It's not necessarily conducive with a ritual.
Yeah. I mean, like, to go back to the ritual idea, let me just give you an example of basically how the initial ritual was structured before I decided I would try and do it in a skydiving sort of sense. And I got this from a book, and I'm trying to remember what it was. I don't know if it was Eat, Pray, Love, or it was another one. Now, don't hate on that book. It's a well-written, enjoyable book, even if it's full of woo-woo ideas. I know atheists are going to tear me a new asshole for saying I like that book.
So much. You know who's going to tear you a new asshole? Carissa. When I said that you like that book, you don't know what happened to her face, man. It sunk.
Has she read the book?
It's depressing.
Has she read the book? Okay.
I believe
that's fair enough, I suppose. Anyways, Elizabeth Gilbert is my hero. I really like her. Even if that half the book is about religion or pseudo-religion and just about wackiness, it's still a very good book.
Well, it's also the fact that she hates it because there have been so many women that have sold everything, gone to these countries, being raped or kidnapped or killed because they bought into the romance, that you're just like, wow. What the fuck?
I suppose that's another way of looking at it. But anyways, got an idea. The ritual idea came from a book, and the example that they had given was a person went and they constructed a boat, and they constructed like a what the heck are these things called? Like kind of not like, you know what a voodoo doll is supposed to be, like your like a physical version of yourself.
Like an avatar?
Yeah, basically. You construct an avatar, and in that avatar, you somehow, as you build it, you imbue it with all of the negative aspects that you're sick of, that you want to get rid of. Sit it in the boat, set the boat on fire, and then push that boat off into the water and watch it burn as it goes out into the lake or into the sea or whatever you've lit it on fire on. And that's an example of a ritual where you're basically purging a whole bunch of stuff. And scientifically, the way that it works is that it's probably on a similar level as a placebo or something else like that. But, you know, when you assign physical, when you do something physical to try and affect mental change, there are times where you can actually trick your brain into the ritual being a positive thing for change.
But that's what it is. A ritual is nothing but a sophisticated way to trick yourself. And in a way, like you mentioned it before, where we don't really have this whole free will idea is a gigantic mistake. Really, what you are, your conscious self.
Yes.
The ability for you to make rational decisions is entirely possible because of all the conflicts that are happening between just baser emotions. They're so busy trying to fight against one another that you, for a brief moment, have a kind of window of clarity. But even within that window of clarity, you just don't even know all the shit that's going down. I mean, you jumped out of an airplane and you can't recall what the fuck happened. It's gone. Like, it's in trauma zone. You didn't make that decision. You didn't be like, I'm going to press the trauma button now because I'm scared. No, it's just you didn't make that decision. So I think the problem that we have, it's really difficult for us to just... sometimes we have to trick ourselves, but trick ourselves in the right way. You know, it's the same reason why the placebo effect works, and why we've always tried to figure out, like, how can we benefit from the placebo effect? Perhaps the way is by using ritual, but in a non-superstitious way, right? There could be other ways to really trick our bodies, to do it knowingly, because the whole tongue-in-cheek thing is, you weren't in control anyways. So you just have to make the right moves. You just have to make it seem like everything is okay, and your body buys it.
Yep. It's all about trying to trick your spinal cord into not resisting the changes that you want to make in your life. Because it's the driver. You're kind of in the back seat, and you hope it's taking you in the right direction, for the most part.
Yeah, I feel I always... I guess I have a part of me that hates the fact that I am in the passenger seat with a lot of experiences, you know, like it's rare that I can claim to have a real degree of control over what's happening, over my emotions, over my decisions. I was like that last week, you know. For, the reason why there wasn't a show, I mean, I put one up, but I was really dissatisfied. And I think it's really because I recorded the podcast from like a really negative zone. I was kind of angry and that kind of stuff. And I'm like, that's not the tone of the show. You know, that's not the whole purpose of this fucking podcast. So I'm going to put that behind. But it was difficult to just try to climb out of that because you're not the one who put yourself there to begin with. It was just part of your brain. You know, that this emotional response that you have is just like, well, sorry, man, nothing I can do about it. I'm just going to pump some fucking chemicals in your brain. You just got to deal with it now. It's like, give me a break, brain. Here's something I found that was really interesting. There really isn't very little consensus when it comes to an agreement about the link between myth and ritual. Because I think that there's a lot of scholars, particularly religious scholars, that tend to think that ritual is a result of mythology. But I actually think that, like anything else, religion sort of like creeps in, says that it's taken over the party, and that it invented everything, promptly destroying all evidence of the contrary. And because really, I mean, we were just talking about it before, we can do things that often trick us. I mean, if you go and you take a placebo pill, you didn't have to join a cult in order for it to work. You just needed to, your body needed to have reassurance that you're taking something that was meant to heal you, even though it was just fucking sugar. There is something strange about that sort of connection. But, I mean, we create an artificial divide between body and mind, right? We assume, we don't understand that we are bodies. We don't have bodies, we are bodies. You are a physical organism. You function as a result of all of these complex organs working in tandem. Some of them start to like go awry and you're fucked.
People are just generally fascinated about the idea of mind over body, though. That's kind of where everybody, that's where the interest starts. That's where people start getting interested in the placebo effect and the positive aspects of ritual and everything else like that. It's kind of neat.
I suppose it makes us feel like we have more power. You know, and that's what human beings crave. They crave power and control over their environment. Like, why else would anyone think that having mental powers would be good? Because if you really think about it, the ability to hear people's minds would be a bad thing. Think about how bad the internet is times like a million. The completely unfiltered thoughts of other human beings. Can you even handle your own uncensored, unfiltered fucking thoughts? Do you want 10,000 more invading you? No, I think the only reason it's attractive is because it makes people feel like, wow, I'm powerful, you know, like, I am like Professor Xavier, I have the ability to be special, and all these other, just, they're attractive, they appeal to us. It's exactly why you should be weary of them. I'm like, sounds too good to be true. Probably.
You know, if Professor X was using his mind powers to sleep with chicks, isn't that a form of rape?
Yeah, well, here's the thing, all right? Imagine you're Professor X and you have mental powers, and I'm just going to play around here and assume mental powers are real, and they function kind of the same way that anything else in nature functions, right? Has its own laws and rules and things like that. So how, and we know that people tend to trick themselves. So how is it that Professor Xavier couldn't trick himself into controlling a woman's mind to sleep with her and not having justified the rape? How could he ever know that?
I don't know. It was kind of horndoggy in that new First Class movie. So it kind of implied the whole idea that he used his mental powers to get with the ladies.
Yeah, well, that's, you know why? That's because everybody does it when they first get it. You know, you misuse your powers until you start realizing that they can get you in serious trouble. It's the follies of youth.
I guess in the 60s, the ground rules were a little bit different, too. So anything was fair play in the 60s.
I don't know, because we have this idea that the 60s were a very liberated time, but that's just the image that we have. And in reality, it became extremely conservative as a response even to the liberalism of the 60s. So disproportionately, people were actually more conservative. And the weird thing too is it kind of goes into ebbs and flows, right? You have like a generation that's going to be a little bit more liberal, and their generation is going to be a little bit more conservative as a result. We have this weird need to be almost exactly the opposite of the generation before us. Maybe it's compulsive. Maybe it's a survival mechanism. If you keep switching over, then you make sure that you never have too much of one side, right? You're like, well, we stay somewhere in the middle. We never get too, you know, left, and we never get too right, so long as everybody's sort of like switching back and forth, passing the ball, being cool about it. It's just that if a person starts grabbing on the ball and playing keep away, that starts being a problem. Did you notice, by the way, when I was compiling some of the notes on ritual, because the whole idea is the various thoughts on the ritual hypothesis, like where does it come from? Why do we have rituals? I guess I think the best explanation so far has a lot to do with the fact that we're superstitious animals. You know, we have a tendency to see pattern that Michael Shermer called patternicity. And I think that that natural affinity to see pattern is what forces us to try to exploit certain patterns and reap their benefit. That's why superstition is not just a belief, it's a set of actions. So if you look at pigeons, superstitious pigeons, for instance, when you give them food randomly, if they were just moving around when the food pellet came out and they think that that's what caused it, they'll do it. So superstition is about action. It's not only about belief. I think this is where we have this notion that a belief and an action are somehow fucking disconnected. Like, oh, no, I believe something, but I act something entirely different. And you're like, no, I mean, fundamentally, they're not. Perhaps in us, we have some beliefs that we don't translate into actions, but like, name a few that you haven't, at least in some fucking regard, right? At least in some degree. Beliefs are actions. So I think that rituals are, like I said before, are a kind of extension of this superstitious belief. And maybe this is the question I want to ask other atheists as we imagine, like, well, what is the world like in a post-religious world, right? A post-superstitious world. Do human beings still need ritual in that world? I think they do. I think that your example of jumping out of a plane is a perfect example of why we do need ritual, because I think that if we don't at least have a few of them, a lot of our experiences will feel less satisfying because we never had a successful narrative of the whole experience.
And I mean, experience does matter. If you take a look at the difference between if you're just sitting around hanging out with people not doing much, or if you go on a camping trip, or you go on a road trip with somebody, or you do something, you experience something with somebody, even if that person is just part of a group of five people or something like that, and you don't interact with them all that much, the fact that you went through that together, it changes things.
Yeah, it's true. I think that's what's probably what you were missing as part of that ritual too, right? Like, the others in the plane weren't doing the same thing as you, I'm assuming?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of the other people jumping it was more for the thrill and just for the experience and everything. I was the only one trying to ritualize and stuff like that. And my whole problem was I didn't get off into my own space as we took off in the plane. It was about 20 minutes to get from you know, ground to 13,000 feet. And rather than, you know, getting my head into the right place, I was kind of interacting with them and being too much in the moment as opposed to building everything around it. But again, the experience ended up being very positive in different ways. And I use it more as a specific instance that I'm moving forward from rather than a, you know, as a ritual. I don't know if it was fully successful. I might still go down and burn a boat or something like that.
Yeah, well, I think it's important for us to never underestimate the importance of ritual. I'll give you an example. This is child soldiers in Mozambique. I have a couple links that I want you guys to check out in the notes. So if you don't know how to access those, by the way, if you have an iPod and you know, anything that uses iTunes, if you go to the lyrics section, then you'll see all the notes that I have available. So you know, notes of the shows and links to some of the really cool articles. And one article in particular that I recommend talks about child soldiers in Mozambique. Like, what are the results? Like, why was it rampant? What were the conditions that caused this? But more importantly, they were really talking about rehabilitation of child soldiers. And one issue in particular they were talking about was the fact that in communities which ritualized, that had purification or cleansing rituals for people that had been child soldiers, there was a significant increase in terms of their sociability, their acceptance within the community, and so on and so forth. Now, this is another aspect I'm like, are we going to continue to ignore this kind of shit? Like, I feel like as non-believers, we're so anxious and scared to be religion that we forget all the fucking aspects of humanity that are, you know, necessary, like socializing, having these kinds of community-built rituals, and so on and so forth. We're not having these conversations. Everybody's like, oh, that's a religion. What the fuck, man? It's like, honestly, without in places like Mozambique, where you don't have a lot of psychologists that are willing to go there, where the only thing available are these types of rituals, and I'm sorry to say religion, to treat this kind of intense trauma, like, what else are we offering, right? What are we offering? Oh, take the bullet, assume that life is cruel, and just move on. You're going to be a pile of ash. Like, this is not a good... This is not a good fucking sell here. It's not a good pitch. We need to work on our copy.
Yeah, atheists and science, well, maybe not scientists, but you know, atheists and skeptics and so forth are always going to look carefully at stuff like this. And you know, we see the woo before we see any of the other facts. So it's just the way that we're wired.
I suppose so. I mean, we will always be forced, just in the nature of who we are, to take extremes, right? So if you take homeopathy as a perfect example. You know, I hate homeopathy, and yet I still have to accept the fact that part of the claims that they make work only because of that sort of psychological influence of this placebo effect, right? They fool people, and part of it works when they fool people. And I'm busy fighting them and not taking advantage of something that we could duplicate, but say we do it without the BS. You know? Like, why can't we do it too? Why can't we harness the good aspects and just forget their bullshit? We just need a non-bullshit variety that is just... It's for the common folks that want something more reasonable, you know? Like the kind of people that whenever you step into one of those places where you want a massage and they start telling you that your chakras are in a line, you're just like, I want a fucking massage!
If you don't believe it, you ain't gonna get better. It's that catch-22. If you invented something that just obviously wasn't true, rather than this homeopathy thing, well, I guess homeopathy is obviously not true, but, you know, people still believe in it. You have to believe! It's like Peter Pan, man! You can't fly if you don't believe.
But what if you decided you were going to believe in something so absurd that it would have no importance, and that belief itself would be the catalyst that you needed? Like, what if you celebrated the obvious tongue-in-cheekness of its non-existence with some clever twist of language or whatever, and then declared because of that it existed and therefore worked? Maybe that it could work. Like, how far can we push the ritual to make reasonable still fool you? Like, you can twist logic any way you want.
I think we'd have to study hipsters more and see how their ironic undertaking of various things is affecting them. I think irony doesn't create the same effect of change that fervent belief does.
Well, we don't know this, actually. We don't really have any studies that would suggest that you need fervent belief. Like, perhaps it only requires a tiny amount. I mean, a lot of people that take medication, they're probably aware that there's a chance that whatever they're taking is a placebo. So I don't think it requires that a person is, like, completely and utterly bowed down to doctors and believe fervently that everything they say is holy and sacred in order for it to have a benefit. I actually think that it doesn't matter what you think. It only matters when you go through the motions. And the rest happens. Because, again, we take that position that, you know, you're not really in control. You're not in the fucking driver's seat. You're in the passenger seat. But... you know, you as a passenger, you can still influence. You're still the navigator. You just have to kind of influence yourself in the right way. Like, how do you want to make that change possible and fool yourself into doing what you want to do? As weird as that is. Speaking of fooling oneself and doing what they really want to do, I want to talk about my dragon that I want to slay, if you don't mind. We'll move on from... The ritual talk, although I would encourage people in the conversations, leave your thoughts. Like, ritualism, by the way, this, you know, or the study of rituals, that's not really that well of an understood thing. You know, like, there's lots of different opinions, no consensus generally. I think it's like one of those fields where we're just begging for a brilliant mind to unlock just the secrets of what makes rituals so powerful and why are they part of the human experience. The questions are still fucking left to be answered, so please, someone out there, if you don't know what you want to do, but you're interested in science, this could be a fucking interesting avenue, because trust me, man, lots of fucking unanswered questions. But I want to talk about, like I said before, I want to talk about the demon that I'm trying to slay. And anyone who's familiar with the podcast, has been listening from the beginning, knows what demon this is. It's the demon that I call the book, the thing that just won't get fucking done, and that's been haunting me for 4 years. And I need to slay it. And I think that part of last week was also when I became a little bit upset at the atheism scene, I suppose. I think I was more upset at myself, because if you don't really craft out what you're going to get out of life, in a sense, out of opportunities that present to yourself, you just feel resentful. You don't know where to move. You feel like you're treading your wheels, that you have no momentum, and that you're wasting everyone's time, which is still, in a sense, what I feel. I mean, not that the podcast is a waste of time, but that I waste my time every time I talk to someone about this book that I just have not written, which makes this podcast kind of ironic, but perhaps ritualistic in the end, cathartic in the end, because I think part of the reason I was reluctant to write the book is because it does, the premise of it sounds like a book that's already out there, and that's not a good start. Kind of makes you feel like, are people going to compare it to that? And, you know, you have those stupid questions you keep asking yourselves.
Yeah, if you're feeling like it's already been done, quote unquote, it always is a gigantic kick in the nuts. And that's something that happens every single day when you're a blogger and you're looking for something to blog about. As soon as you find something, that something has probably already been blogged about by 6 or 7 people. And it's really hard to get your ass onto the keyboard and to write out your own thing, even though it might be the same thing. It has already been done, and it's very frustrating to get over that Simpsons did it attitude. But Simpsons have done everything, and you can't let Simpsons did it stop you from doing something of your own.
Yeah, because your version might just be better. So I think the challenge for me was accepting the fact that it's not a I can't win on originality. And there may be some degree of it which might punish me, but it's still, I feel like as if I don't do it the way that, you know, I had originally envisaged, it's going to be an utter failure and continue to just be a number of false upstarts. Like, I went through the list of all the failed attempts of the book, and I'm like, I could write a book about failed attempts. This is ridiculous. It just, you know, when I did find the formula that I'm writing it from the perspective, if you want, of I'm trying to write this as if I was trying to explain to an alien that has never seen any human beings what's the deal with us, what's the deal with us, what's the deal with where we live, and obviously this is a bit of a swan song, if you want, because by the time anybody that, you know, or any other sentient being in the galaxy or the universe has picked it up, we've been long dead. All right, our species has probably been wiped out. The solar system's probably been destroyed. It's a kind of, hey, you know, so long and thanks for all the fish kind of thing. But at the same time, what I hope to do from it is I kind of want people to just examine themselves from that same perspective. Like, can we just look at our nature from that detached, why do we do the things that we do kind of way? Because there are certain explanations to things, like, for instance, we know why there are seasons. And that may sound really arbitrary, but if you're trying to explain to an alien why there are seasons, it's a surprisingly long conversation. And it's also one that kind of affects everything else. It affects the way that we evolved, it affects the way that our planet behaves, it affects so much of it, just as a consequence of what happened. And I think that that story itself is one that is interesting not only for us, but hopefully, maybe, will be interesting for other alien life if they have a sense of humor that's similar. Because if I don't assume they do, but they're not going to be paying the bills. So it'll still be written with a sense of humor for humans.
You're writing the book for aliens.
Well, you know, I'm so sick and tired of writing for humans. Like, I keep joking that I want to make the narrative and take the human out of it. Like, the new narrative. Why do we need a human narrative to everything? It's fucking played out. I'm so bored. I mean, it's always the same thing too, right? You know, it's about friendships and romances and political drama and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm sick and tired of humans. Can we just talk about something else for a little while? Like, this human-centricness is just, I mean, certainly if there's alien life out there, they're probably doing something really interesting that we should think about. Or at least speculate on. Because it's not just... I mean, part of it will be... And this will be the fun part, as far as I'm concerned. Because if I could have been any scientist, it would have been an exobiologist. But talk about a fucking useless science in our age. it's like in 300 years, maybe. But for now, it blows. For now, it's just like this the science of speculation. But I figure I get to have a whole chapter of me speculating what life is, sentient life out there could be like. That's going to be my pleasure. So I think that's going to be fun. I think the whole process is going to be really just fun, and I've kind of been punishing myself and not doing it, or even feeling like a fucking failure because it never happened. But that's why I just need to slay the dragon and move the fuck on. Jesus.
Yep, it's time to do stuff. That's what everything is all about. Between jumping out of a plane and between sitting down and writing a book, it's all about just saying, here's what I know I want to do, here's how I'm going to do it, and here's how I'm going to accomplish it. I kind of feel like everybody has a harder time than maybe they should accomplishing the things they want to get done. And part of that is we have so many distractions, and part of that is I don't think we're as organized as we probably should be because we have so many of these distractions. How much time do you, fair listener, take every day thinking about what you're going to be doing over the next day or over the next week, over the next month, and the goals that you have and how you're going to accomplish them point by point, how much time you're going to put into them, and really holding yourself accountable to sitting down and putting the work in on all of these things that are above and beyond your entertainment needs or your specific job.
I guess it's tough. People are always torn between conflicting emotions. I mean, you have probably the desire, dear listener, of, you know, being entertained. That's why you're listening to this show. At least I hope so. Jeez. There is that need for you, probably because aspects of your job or your studies or whatever it is that you're doing is less than satisfactory or pleasant. That is not uncommon. And in those kinds of situations, I always feel like I lose more time. I find that when I'm depressed or if I'm, like, feeling blue, that's where time really does slip away from me. Where I try to find any opportunity I can to find time sinks that just, you know, you're like, what happened to that month, to that last month? Oh, well, you just buried yourself in bullshit and you didn't bother to do anything that you were interested in doing in the first place. You know, I think that the problem sometimes is we're so overwhelmed by, you know, everyday life that even though the things that we like doing, we just don't feel motivated because, you know, like for the very reason that you said, we're not organized enough to get it off, kickstart it past the point of just doing it, like, say, from hobby to living, which is, I think, for a lot of people that listen, like, ultimately the goal, right? Whatever it is that you love doing, hopefully is what you're fucking doing for the rest of your life, but fuck, that's hard. Especially when you have time sinks and the desire to escape reality.
Well, your brain is really good at just going on autopilot, and once it's got the routine down, it'll keep you in it. We follow patterns, and we do the same thing. And if you're not careful about it, you just you need to make the effort to anytime you want to expand your horizons, because your brain will be there trying to just keep you in the same safe thing that you're doing now. And the older you get, I kind of think like that the more resistant your brain is to change. So, although I'd have to look into seeing whether or not that's the case as far as scientific study is concerned.
I'm resistant to that idea. Well, you know what? I think before we leave, I kind of would love if people shared, you know, if you feel up to it in the comment section, shared some of the rituals that you perform that aren't religious, you know, some of the things that you find you do to almost either fool yourself or feel like whatever actions you're taking are more concrete. Because I think that, you know, if you have a great ritual, there are certain lessons that we can draw from them. That, you know, because I don't think that we're a ritualistic type of folks, us non-believers and skeptics. We're not. And I think that at least there's a portion of it. It's a very small portion, but I think it is an important portion that is still necessary for us to try and see if we can't benefit from as well. Like, why should we not take the good stuff too, just because of our nature? I actually think we could come up with some hilarious and brilliant rituals of our own that are just fun rather than depressing or violent or, you know, because the list of human, you know, rituals throughout time has probably been pretty dark.
Yep, it's true. Like, there's some, what is it? I think it's a South American tribe where your ritual from being a boy to a man is they basically grind a small hole in your skull and stuff it full of, like, psychedelic plants that drive you crazy for a week.
They can't just make you eat it?
Well, I mean, apparently sticking it right in the brain is even better than, like, doing it up your nose or doing, like, a rectal parachute.
So you're talking about, like, a super trip balls shit. Wouldn't be surprised if lots of them are totally psychotic by the end of it.
Well, they go psychotic during the whole episode. Like, it gets you to the point where, you know, time stops and you are infinity and all the rest of that. It's like, it's some deep shit. It takes you over the edge. And, of course, it's a ritual, so they take care of you and make sure you don't, like, die in a swamp or go drown or accidentally, if this was a village that had windows, jump out of a third-story window. But, you know, that kind of stuff. They protect you from yourself, but, yeah, you were completely gone during the entire process.
Well, next, the last bonus show, the one that I didn't make, was supposed to be on drugs. And I wanted to also, like, to stick with the promise of making the next show about drugs, specifically because there had been a few talks about it and articles written by Sam Harris about the topic. And I think that you're partial to what he says. I think we could have some interesting discussions about the, you know, the types of experience that people have on these drugs that... I don't want to say the lessons that we draw from them, because that might be the wrong word, but the variety of experience that these drugs provide and really what the fuck that's all about. And even some hilarious theories that people have, including the idea that drugs is what created the conscious human mind. So there'll be...
Oh, yes, yeah.
Remember that one.
The stoned ape theory.
So that'll be among some of the topics that we'll be talking about. The philosophy of psychedelics will be the topic of the bonus show, as promised but not delivered. What can I say? Sometimes, eh? Take a vacation. You know what's crazy,
though? We're back on track.
Well, I know we are, but you jumped out of a fucking airplane. If a person says, like, put your money where your mouth is, at least one of us did it.
Yep, it was pretty intense. I regret nothing. It's cheaper than you'd expect. It's not inexpensive. It's like around, if anybody wants to do it, nowadays it's around $250 for a tandem jump. And I fully support anybody going out and doing that if they just want an extreme thrill, because it's probably the craziest thing you'll do in your life. I can't think of a more quote-unquote Mountain Dew extreme moment.
You should have eaten some Doritos and drank some Mountain Dew before you jumped.
Oh, you know Mike, right? Yeah. Mike did it on 2CB.
What the fuck is 2CB?
2CB is like Acid's little brother, little painter brother. Yeah.
What did he say after?
He said it was quite intense.
And he's a man who's accustomed to intensity.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. He's a psychonaut. So it was totally within his whole thing that he would do it like that. I was like, I'm not going to do anything that increases the chances of me bugging out, peeing, or pooping my pants.
All of which are always possible whenever you bug out.
Oh, no, seriously, I'm always paranoid about peeing my pants. I had this one drug experience where I thought I might have peed my pants, and it's haunted me to this day.
Right, it's not even, we're not even sure that you did, but you're pretty sure you did.
No, I'm more leaning on the side that I probably didn't, because you figure you'd remember it. But...
Oh, come on, man, that's what Fergie. And I've been a lot. Fergie said, man.
And I know, but here, and I've been a lot higher in the past as well, and not done it. So I just don't know. But the possibility that I might have always puts me in the mindset of always watch out, because you never know when you just might pee your pants.
I guess that's a life lesson. Thank you for sharing the life lesson to all the future psychonauts wannabe, which you should probably listen to the bonus show, because it'll be it's probably not a good idea to do that show. But with, you know, tongue in cheek, I'm not here to moralize fucking anybody. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I ain't your peppy. I'm just your entertainment, and that's what we're going to do, and that's what we're going to keep doing. So we'd like to thank everybody that's a contributing member. I've sent out a message to all of you hardcore members that have been at least hardcore for at least 6 months and haven't, you know, had accidentally missed payments or anything else like that. If you've had 5 to 6 consecutive months of hardcore memberships, we're trying to get your address information so we can send you your shirts. Like, we want to get that promotion over and out so we can actually move to the new promotion. So please, if you're a hardcore member, you need to email me. That's jake@thegoodatheist.net. Email me your address information, and we're going to send you your shirt. Obviously, we have to ask you for sizes, although there is limited quantities for certain sizes. So please give us your information first, because if not, you're going to be part of the second batch, and that's not going to be for a little while. So get in now. Get your information in now. Some of you are slow to get this. So
get your swag.
Get your swag, bitches. You know you wants it. I mean, that was the whole idea. I want to encourage hardcores, give you some shirts, and I want people to take pictures. That's one of the things that I want. Like, you get your shirt with the Jesus Saves or with any of the other designs we're going to be doing, take a picture and put it on this site, maybe even as your profile picture or something like that. Maybe we'll do a cool little contest if we get more prizes and stuff like that, which I'm hoping we're going to be able to do. I've been talking to some potential sponsors. You know, it's not huge money, but we've got some pretty good numbers, so I think that guarantees us at least, the very least, some very interesting stuff that we can start offering people. Wouldn't that be fun?
I like it.
All right, we're going to catch everybody on Thursday for the bonus show. With that, my name is Jacob Fortan.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.